Session is called "The World is With Us at the Banquet, the Kingdom Comes." And there's a subscript to that, first called "Christians, the Kingdom Comes," and you'll find out why it's just, these Holden titles are so confusing. At least if we get nowhere else, maybe the title makes sense at the end of the session. I work for Lutheran World Relief, and what I'm going to say is based on my work for Lutheran World Relief. How many of you are Lutherans? Jeez, we're doing well. Okay, so I'm going to assume a few things about Lutheran World Relief. Perhaps you know it's 50 years old and it's active in about 40 countries, and it is a joint ministry of the ELCA and of the LCMS. My comments also draw a little bit on my previous work, which just ended last year, which was as a missionary in the Middle East for the ELCA. And I tend to be always working in media, so there's a bit of a bias towards that. And although the approach of these little series is to say that the Sunday texts call us to a banquet with the world, they call us to a global Christianity, to rub shoulders with people over the horizon. If, in an allegory, you were at this great banquet that we hope for, and you turned and met the person next to you, who would that person be? And I think it's surprising who that person would be if we have a global perspective to our Christianity and we're able to perhaps meet people that we didn't even know were part of the body of Christ and guests at the banquet. Yesterday we talked about those people. Today it's more oriented towards action, a banquet with action, and that action related to the kingdom. And I'd like to just look at two of the texts. This was for a Sunday last summer in June of 1994. And the first one is up here on the board, Acts 11, 19 to 30, and chapter 13, 1 through 3. And I'd invite you to read it quietly to yourself. If you're done reading and you'd like to chat with your neighbor, there's a few minutes for that. And then I'll say some things about it, and I welcome your interruptions and comments as we go along. So Acts 11, 19 to 30, and chapter 13, 1 through 3. Well, let me recap perhaps a few of the main verses here, if I see that most people are finished. In verse 19, they talk about some places, Phoenicia, Cyprus, Antioch, what happened in those places to which the people had been scattered after the persecution of Stephen. The hand of the Lord was with them. Great numbers believed. And Barnabas came from Jerusalem. He saw the grace of God. He rejoiced. He exhorted them to be faithful. That progression came, saw grace, rejoiced. With the footnote, he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith. It struck me a very linear progression here. Came, saw grace, rejoiced. And verse 24, a great many were brought to the Lord. A lot of us like to think linearly. There's a woman in the village this week who's going to do something on non-linear art from the right side of the brain. Look for her courses. But this line, very much, I think, in that way, as we get set up for this action banquet that I'm trying to talk about, Barnabas needed help. He got it from Saul. They met. They taught the people for how long? A year? A whole year? And then in verse 26, what does it say? That sort of seminal moment for our kind of religion, the place they were first called Christians was Antioch. It's a wonderful story, I think, of God calling his people to new life in him. And as we go into that, I always think of an aside, because as I say, coming out of the privilege I've had to work in that part of the world, and the privilege you have through the ELCA to be connected to that part of the world, to the Christians of that part of the world, especially those members of the Middle East Council of Churches, which unites all the varieties of Christendom, many varieties we don't have here, under one roof for the first time in 1,500 years, since some of the splits that shook the church in the first millennium. But these places come to life. Phoenicia, what's Phoenicia?
Lebanon,
absolutely. And to this day, 50% of that country perhaps growing from these people scattered there then. 50% is Christian. Cyprus, who was from Cyprus? Barnabas. Barnabas was a Cypriot. 100% Christian, at least nominally, the Church of Cyprus, the Greek Orthodox Church of Cyprus. Antioch. Anybody make any connections to Antioch in the present-day church? Do you know what it's called? It's a place in Syria, and the Greek Orthodox Church, which speaks Arabic and uses Arabic in its services and has Arabic priesthood and leadership, is called the Church of Antioch to this day. The boss that I worked for in the Middle East was a member of the Church of Antioch. So the people scattered in those days are still there. What did they do when the new life, with the new life that they had been found? What's the very first thing that we are told in this passage is what they did with the new life that they had been found?
Relief.
Yeah, famine relief. This is kind of a gift to anybody who works for a place called Lutheran World Relief. But word came from Jerusalem of a famine, and the disciples, each according to his or her ability, sent relief to the believers in Judea. But that's not the end of the story. If we look at the three verses from chapter 13, they had talents, and God used their talents. The Holy Spirit picked Saul and Barnabas. They fasted, they prayed, they laid hands on these people, and sent them out. And what happens when you send people out, then as now, is what we come to very promptly in the gospel. But I'd like to dwell for a minute first on this concept that the church, which is so old there, the early church which is described, is still very much alive and well. And I went into this last week a little bit, and I'd like to... How many of you were here last Wednesday, Thursday? Okay.
Last week.
All right. I think it's a fair... Pardon?
Last week or this week?
Last week. I'd like to go into this briefly. Because many of us aren't aware that the places spoken of, as I've just mentioned, represent today still 12 to 14 million Christians in the Eastern Orthodox family, in the Oriental Orthodox family, in the Roman Catholic family, in the Assyrian, we could also speak of in a fourth branch. But these people are still there following in the manner just described for us, still following their shepherds, still on the land where the faith sprouted, and still, I like to think, at their best, straightforward in their faith in this linear manner that we see here from Acts. I had the privilege to visit a village in South Jordan, which is both Roman Catholic and Bedouin. It's in the middle of the desert, on the edge of the desert, in the middle of the very dry southern half of Jordan. And one story that the priest told me as we did a small video about the people in that village trying to introduce Westerners to a Christian family there. I said, "How is the faith of your people?" The Roman Catholic priest. And he told me a story about a time when the previous priest was all cozy inside the parsonage in this desert village on a winter's night. And in Jordan, in the winter, it rains. It's cold. And a man came to him in the parsonage and said, "Father, my wife is terribly sick. I'm not sure she's going to die, but she's been sick for a long time. I badly want her to have the Holy Eucharist." And the priest, apparently not as young and sprightly as the one I was talking to, said, "Oh, I can't go out to your tent, your Bedouin tent. It's across the wadi. There's a huge flow of water down the wadi. It's difficult to get across. It's too difficult for me. Wait for the water to go down or something." But he put the man off. And the man persisted. And finally the man said, "I'll carry you so that you can give the Eucharist to my wife." A Bedouin woman in a tent in the desert. And that's what the man did. He carried the priest across the rushing river, winter torrent, and brought him to his place. Now, you could look at that story the other way around and say that doesn't say much for the priesthood of those churches. But I think it says something about the simple faith of the people. Another story from the same village. It's a place where only sheep and goats can convert the sparse vegetation into life for human beings. You couldn't live there unless helped by an animal like a sheep or a goat who can live on next to nothing. They will drive them out in the morning across brown hills, and you can't see anything that those herds can possibly eat. The priest likes to speak of traffic jam in that village as being the time between 5 and 6 in the morning when all the flocks come out of the enclosures they've been in during the night and head out in all directions of the compass. And the later it is in the summer, the farther they have to go to find that little tiny bit of greenery which is still there. But they turn it into mutton and into milk, into yogurt. And indeed, the people lived on simple things like that for a long, long time. Well, at one point, these sheep were sick and dying of no known cause. The shepherds tried every remedy they could find. Nothing worked. They finally went to the priest in desperation to ask for him to intervene. Perhaps God could help. The priest wasn't there, and only some nuns were there. And it's a male-dominated society and a male-dominated church. And the nuns didn't feel that they had the power to do anything about this. But then the villagers had a bright idea. They said, allow our sheep to come into the church, and they will be healed. And the nuns were all taken aback because this was beyond their authority as well. And all they could say was, well, they're going to make it dirty. And the shepherds replied, our daughters will come and clean the church after the flocks have been through. So the nuns relented, and the flocks came in, and they were driven around and around inside the church. And the nuns prayed as best they were able, and the flocks went out. And from that time forth, there were no further losses in the herds of that village. And the story is told to this day. This is a story from 20 years ago. It's told to this day as an example of the people's faith in that part of the world. So we can tarry a little with the New Testament lesson, with this New Testament church, with the places that people were first called Christians, and take a little bit of instruction, I think, from the fact that in this, as we've been hearing all week, this Eastern book, we Westerners have some things to learn that perhaps we don't see at first glance about what it means to be Jesus' flock. Could we look together at the gospel lesson, which is also up here, Matthew 10, verses 7 to 16, and read it with a mind for what happens when we get sent out. We've been hearing of this witness, we've been hearing what it means to be called Christians, but that first lesson set us up for this idea of sending out, not only relief, but people, evangelists. What happens when they're sent out? If we were to struggle with the question, you know, what does it mean that the kingdom of God has come near? What kind of leading, what kind of answer does this text give us?
Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons.
Yeah. The immediate, at first it does say proclaim the very fact, right? Mm-hmm. But then, what are they? Heal,
raise the dead,
raise,
cleanse, drive out, in this translation.
Drive out, cast out, demons.
Preach first, as you go.
Preach as you go, yeah, go. Preach, go, heal.
Right. Oh, that's what you got. Okay.
The answer is in the verbs. The answer is in the doing. The kingdom of God draws near as people do those verbs, according to this.
Why did you leave out the exclusiveness of the two verses before? Go only to the, do not.
Go nowhere near among the Gentiles.
Go nowhere near the Gentiles.
Well, I'll pass that one off to whoever does the lectionary. That's verse 6?
Verse 5 and 6.
Yeah. The reading for that Sunday was 7 through 16. Is there a better man than I here, or a woman, that could answer this? Joan?
Who knows their own stupid things?
I think it's typical of the church to read it with the accenting of the focus that is there.
With the which of the focus?
With the absence of the focus that this gentleman calls attention to.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been tradition for the church not to read in the New Testament the Jewishness that's there.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in the other text, but the fact that it is basically a Jewish church from the beginning.
Right.
And but we leave out those verses sometimes in lectionaries for very good purposes. 1900 years of anti-Jewishness in the church,
mm-hmm.
and that's the kind of thing that happens if we aren't careful.
Okay. Other comments on the point? I don't think it abrogates what we're going to talk about or what we hear in the reading. It's perhaps a framing we need to talk about, but as we proceed with this concept of what is the kingdom of God and how does it come, it seems to be in the verbs. And I just made a little list of places where the New Testament mentions the kingdom and the ways in which they describe it. And it's always described in terms of saving, of finding, of raising up. The list we just had, but a few others that we know so well, it comes by us whenever we see him in Matthew 25, hungry, thirsty, naked. Whenever we see someone, we see Christ in that state. It comes when we seek the pearl of great price. It comes when we are yeast for the whole loaf. It comes when wheat takes root and brings a harvest. And it comes when that tiny mustard seed becomes powerful enough, becomes a huge bush, or something powerful enough to move mountains. Do we know what these verses mean? Do they carry their punch for us in our lives, or in other people's lives that we look to for guidance and inspiration? What do they mean? Do they mean more than what they say, or less?
They went out and did it.
Yeah.
They had power.
Right. It seems pretty simple, pretty mm-hmm. straightforward.
Mm-hmm. But there's different facets to each of those things. There's different depths to them. You know, I see people who've been raised from the dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been raised from the dead.
Right.
While I was very much alive. My body was alive. My spirit was dead. You know, so there's just, yes, it happens, and we see it all the time, if you stop and listen and look.
Right.
But it's like a gemstone that, you know, it changes as you turn it, and there's all different kinds of healing and raising and cleansing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Perhaps deeply or many faceted.
Yeah.
Other comments, reactions on that? I think in the direct sense, it's nothing, you know, more complicated, nothing less important than the direct action that we might find in that wonderful verse about pure religion undefiled is visiting widows in their affliction. You know, that's always just made me sit down. I mean, it's so focused for us. I think in a life where we're frustrated by our lack of direct action of this nature, when life is somehow broken up into things that don't make so much sense, and when you have moments where you do are able to do this, or where you know somebody who's able to do this, it speaks so loudly to us, and I think is a clue. And especially about this question about the kingdom coming. When Jesus taught us how to pray, what did he said? You know, the kingdom comes, and the very next line is, thy will be done. That automatic progression from the kingdom coming to the doing of God's will, that the kingdom comes when God's will is done. And that maybe the kingdom isn't all that much more complicated than that very thing. You know, this idea of the kingdom being with us here, being something we do experience as a wedge that leads to heaven, not as a sudden experience when we die and gain our reward, but that progressive, incremental sense of the coming of the kingdom. And in line with our theme of when the world is with us at the banquet. Now, I struggled a little bit here. Who's been going around driving out demons, casting out demons? Occasionally we have a story, you know, The Exorcist was a good film for about 20 years. things like that. But
a bad film for 20 years.
A bad film for 20 years. It raised the topic for us. Are there examples from your experience? The one that came to me, because of the timing of these readings, was, as I mentioned yesterday, in a different context, Rwanda. Not that we were casting out demons, but that we were helping people who had seen and experienced demons in action. And this text occurred right in June, when the genocide was still going on last year in Rwanda. And I'd like to mention that briefly and quote a little bit from a churchman from that country as he reflects on what's happened there now in the past year and why, how it happened. A little tiny a review of Rwanda, that we have a case here where for various reasons, but essentially a people who did know how to live together, who didn't make that much distinction between themselves, were brought to the point where through the plan of a small privileged clique at the top, turned on a substantial part of the country and began to annihilate it. People in charge, in power, so concerned to retain their position that they went to the length of using murder, mass murder, genocide, as a means of politics. Politics by murder, if you only had three words to say. Not tribal warfare. That's an imperfect, inadequate, superficial word. And so many times our media spoke of it as tribal warfare. We think of Africa, oh God, tribal warfare again. It's not fair to what happened. It doesn't in any way explain what was able to be done in 10 weeks in Rwanda last summer, where from 500,000 to 1 million people were killed, where half the country had to leave its home and flee, where half of that half had to leave the borders of the country, and a good portion of them are still outside the country in camps held hostage by the government that perpetrated the genocide. When the genocide failed, or was stopped because of the victory of the opposing army as it came into the country, those who had been perpetrating genocide turned their tactics, they turned their radio propaganda from saying, kill the Tutsis, kill the moderate Hutus who are enemies of the present regime, turned it and say, you are going to be killed because you are guilty with us of what that was understood, guilty with us of what has been done to these people who are now winning. And people fled in fear, in numbers that can only be explained by mass media. 1.5 million people still camped outside their borders of their country, held hostage by the leaders, and I would say by the demons that were loosed in that country.
Go through that again, you lost me. They turned it and the propaganda from the media said what I...
Sorry, I'm trying to cover too much ground in a short amount of time. The radio was used for years to build up to the point where it began to speak of the Tutsis, of the RPF, the rebels coming in, as cockroaches. And that was a code word in Nyenzi, cockroach, for all of the enemies of the regime and all of the people in favor of a multi-party system. And when the time came, with that softening up, people turned on these cockroaches. They knew who they were, and that was became part of the justification to kill them. As the regime began to lose the civil war, the radio turned and said, watch out what the cockroaches are going to do to you. And enough people fled in fear of reprisal of the genocide, so that it's sometimes a revelation, even for people who have given money and tried to help with the Rwandan refugees, the people we're feeding, the people we're helping, are the Hutu majority supporters. We're supporting the people who were behind the government that did the genocide, because they're the ones who fled in the end. The ones you saw streaming into Goma last summer at this very time, they weren't the Tutsis running away from the machetes. They were the people who had used the machetes on the Tutsis. Many of them not, of course, but among them the young men, as I said yesterday, who had been the leaders of the genocide. So you have this fear of reprisal, which is the second consequence of the demons. I mean, the demons were those who killed, I believe. And there was a cover of Time magazine that said, there are no devils left in hell, they're all loose in Rwanda. And our situation since that time, even as it broke, was to be there among the first agencies to help through the Lutheran World Federation on the scene. They had a truckload of aid going to some early Tutsi refugees in April 12th. The killing started April 6th. They were on the scene as 500,000 people fled to Tanzania at the end of May. And the first airplane into Goma, where all those people died of cholera, which was actually a very much of a sideshow to the whole drama, the first airplane into Goma was Lutheran World Federation. Again, the kind of thing you support through Lutheran World Relief and its partnerships. There from the beginning, bringing in supplies and food and managing camps and pulling the bodies out of the river. At one time in Tanzania there were 10,000 people an hour coming over the bridge and one body a minute going under the bridge. And no other agency but Lutheran World Federation was willing to take on the low-profile, grisly task at that point of pulling the bodies out of the river. Later, others joined in along the shores of Lake Victoria. But this almost physical reminder of what the demons had done, and this incredible task, now a year old, of feeding these people without much hope of a solution. Because why? Because the larger task of making justice in that horrible situation is being ignored by the international community. Those people won't go home until they feel safe. They won't feel safe until someone is punished for what was done in Rwanda. And there will enough debt has been paid that the reprisal won't be against them, because they are linked with the prior regime. One woman that we met in one of the videos we worked on at this time, or June last year, had fled with five children. The killers came to their village. She, in the melee, as the militia began to chop people up, four of her children were killed. And she managed to escape into a river with a baby on her back. She hid in the river underneath the vegetation for 3 days until the militia were long gone, and out of her fear she could re-emerge and try to get across the river to Tanzania. In the 3 days she was in the river, the baby on her back died. So she was in the camp by herself. And you have hundreds of thousands of people with similar experiences. In this case, someone faced by the massacre. As I said before, the majority of those implicated by the same sort of thing. Let me read you a small comment from a Rwandan pastor who is part of the almost Bonhoeffer-like surviving church that has stayed in the country and tried to face the consequences of what has happened there on this question of how do demons get loose in a country, really. And it's interesting to note as a foreword that in prior massacres, when other political storms created intergroup killings in Rwanda, and there's a whole list of the dates that are involved. It's happened about six or seven times, never on this scale. But every other time, churches were a sanctuary. So the Tutsis, who are usually the brunt of this attack, because they had been the colonial pimps, the Belgians and the Germans used them basically as people to run the country. The elite of the Tutsi group. They fled to their churches, they were safe. Priests and nuns were safe. But there was never anybody who was punished for those earlier massacres. And then when this one came along in 1994, not only were churches not safe, some of the worst massacres occurred in churches. And priests and nuns, something like a third of the Catholic priests were killed. About half of them fled the country. They were either compromised by defending the people or compromised by fleeing, as the many other refugees did. And this pastor, Aaron Mugomera, says he is alone. His entire family, six children and his spouse, were butchered by militia before his eyes. He was in hiding when the militia burst into the house where they had fled for safety. As he watched, unable to do anything, the seven members of his family were hacked to death. To add to his pain, the killers were members of his congregation, and some of whom he had baptized. His sad eyes reflect his loneliness and pain. And here's his reflection. Why did the message of the gospel not reach the people who were baptized? Why did we lose? What did we lose? We lost our lives. We lost our credibility. We are ashamed, we are weak, but most of all, we lost our prophetic mission as a church. We could not go to the president and tell him the truth because we became sycophants to the authorities. He's speaking of the previous years of this country. We have had killings here since 1959. No one condemned them. During the First Republic, they killed slowly, slowly, but no one from the churches spoke out. No one spoke on behalf of those killed. During the Second Republic, there were more killings, and more people were tortured and raped and disappeared, and we did not speak out because we were afraid and because we were comfortable. Now there has to be a new start, a new way. We must accept that Jesus' mission to us to preach the gospel means that we must be ready to protect the sheep, the flock, even if it means we must risk our lives, to lay down our lives for our sisters and brothers. The Bible does not know Hutu and Tutsi, neither should we. Now, this by way of saying that demons were loose in Rwanda. Demons were able to take over enough people to do this amount of damage. Why? I think you could almost say because of the vacuum left by the church being too close to the regime that was behind the massacre in the end, that would go to that length in the end to protect itself. And our feeble attempt, if you like, to relate to this gospel is to only see by default what it is when you don't drive out demons. You know, what other terms can we understand this disaster in, except that demons were not driven out. And then the kingdom of God doesn't come. It vanishes. And if we were to talk about the session on Rwanda, the title would have to be, you know, the world wisseth at the banquet, Rwanda is not here. And how long will it be till it will ever be here again because of these horrible activities? That larger effort to bring justice there, I have to say, is something that church agencies are urging, but the international community is not taking up very, very powerfully, and the prospects are not good for it. And you could even say that perhaps if this had happened in the Cold War times, whosoever client Rwanda had been, if it had been ours or the Soviets, would be so embarrassed that it would probably maybe help to see that something had been done by it. But thugs in charge of countries can do this now, and what will the international community do? It's our lot as Christians to sit there with the pieces, perhaps, since maybe our job isn't to, in the end, beat our brains out about this justice question, unless the state will take responsibility. But we are stuck with the pieces, and it's very poignant to Rwanda because it's been 30 years with other groups of refugees from that country who have needed help outside of their country in much smaller numbers. So how can church agencies deal with 1.5 million refugees? Jack?
So am I understanding you to say that a lot of the failures at the present time of the whole international community are simply the aftermath of the end of the Cold War and the vacuum that things are in?
Yeah, that's a big topic, and I'm not sure I'm the one to interpret it, but I think that it did keep a lid on certain other problems, and now that that lid is gone, we see some of the deeper realities that are possible, and we see the lengths to which leaders will go to hold on to power. And to call it a flare-up of ethnic rivalry, I think that's a cop-out. You know, speak to a Yugoslav, speak to a Bosnian or a Croat. They won't tell you that they've been dying to kill Muslims for 50 years under Tito, and now they finally can. They'll talk about what has been done in their name by their leaders and the fears that have been played on, the opportunistic politics, the potential for fear and prejudice to be nurtured. And that I think challenges us as churches perhaps more than the Cold War ever did, which is something we might think about, that we are closer to human nature and human society and its real questions, not diverted by this bogus discussion of capitalism versus communism on that score. I don't know if that helps. Other comments or questions? Verse 8 of the gospel says, "You received without payment, give without payment." And I think it's fair to say Let's pause for a minute, how true this is, how much we have received, how much God has blessed us. And I want to show you a little video at the end here, following on what we did yesterday, where there's an hour coming up on NBC, especially if you'll call your local NBC station and ask for this program to be run. It's called Story Barn World Friends. And it's built around the premise that God has given us everything we need to live. In very simple, almost 10-year-old terms, to try to show from around the world the blessings of God, all that He has given us, that when we're talking about the basic requirements of life, those things are in hand from His bounty. And if you make a list of what you have that you didn't pay for, what does it include?
Everything.
You know, you paid for this. You paid for the clothes on your back.
Yeah.
But did you?
Life.
Right. But I mean, I just made a quick one. You know, talents, love, personality, education, country, natural wonders in a place like this, work, friends. And the little segment we're going to see today is that question of God providing us with friends. And I think that's especially poignant here in Holden, where you know, a lot of us probably aren't making that many friends in our daily life. We're too busy. We're in too many channels. And you realize how easy it is to make friends, at least on Holden terms, you know, as you chat, and it's acquaintances at least. I mean, you see some potential in Holden is almost like a reawakening to the blessing of friendship, or at least conversation and acquaintance. I say that as a male who has time to talk with other males, for example, at a place like this. So some of the blessings from God that we didn't pay for and that we are to give without payment. But with the warning of verse 15, to communities and to those of us who do not listen to the good news, it's more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah at judgment than for that town. And I think we've got Sodom and Gomorrah coming up tomorrow night in the lesson. Is that right? Or was that last week? It can't get much tougher than that. The kingdom doesn't come. In fact, it goes from us. In the case where we go the way of sin and death, and our towns go that way. The opposite of responding to this kind of a call. A board member at LWR, who doesn't live too far from here, tells a story of a little exercise done in a church where a loaf of bread was taken, and it was divided between 40 children. 40 children were called to the front. They're divided up into three quarters and one quarter. He took the loaf of bread and divided it. Three quarters of the loaf given to the one quarter, the ten kids, and one quarter of the loaf given to the three quarters. And they were told to share it among themselves as best they could. And of course, the 30 who had the 10 loaves had to figure out how many pieces to tear it up into, so they would each get some. And that was not done too easily. And then the 10 who had the 30 slices were able to easily come to the point where they could say, we have three slices each, and looking pretty good. And as the congregation focused, especially on the 10 with three loaves, three slices each, the pastor asked how that felt for that little group. And a little boy perked up immediately and said, great, from the 10. And the congregation laughed. And then they fell silent. The allocation we face in the world is actually not even that good. If we speak of the world and the banquet that we are sharing in the world, and we take 100 people and sit them around that banquet table, a third of that, of the 100 people at that table, 35 people, have problem with food in their daily life. They may not be starving, may not be dying of malnutrition, some of them are, but food is a question for a third of the people at the banquet. For half the people at the banquet, this same half, a chance in life is a real question. The chance to learn how to read and write, the chance to drink clean water, and escape the diseases that are borne by water in poor communities. affects half the people in the world. If you draw the line at two-thirds of the banquet has a problem with resources, with jobs, with money, a real problem, are called poor in our terminology. And the final third is where we find ourselves, and we are five people, we Americans, five people at the head of the table, and between us, we have about a third of the income, and we have more than a third of the food. We have something like 70% of the automobiles and 82% of the bathtubs, and there's some wonderful statistics that go with our affluence here. We also have only one person at the whole table who has a college degree. If we speak again of the distribution of the blessings in the world, compared to the 50% who are not even taught to read and write. And I think that we can't help but see statistics like that and wonder a little bit about the direct interpretation of some of these passages, that it behooves us in the deepest sense as Christians to tie our faith to our response to those statistics, because it's not too theological, the action recommended by the gospel story. It's action which addresses directly the illness in terms of health and raising from the dead, cleansing the lepers, driving out the demons, the links between poverty and injustice, the chance to manipulate whole groups of people and put them into situations that don't bear any witness whatsoever to the gospel. Any comments or reactions? Can we take that direct a connection between statistics like this and our text? It, as I say, it goes with my job, but does it go with your life? Does it go with your understanding of our faith? Yeah.
Did you say one out of every 100 people has the equivalent of a college degree?
In the world. And how many of us have college degrees? I mean, that person is an American by all statistics. Now, I'd like to do a sort of an honest commercial here. It's not that this stuff is impossible, because as Christians in this country, there are lots of avenues to put this into action. And the one that I know best, of course, is where I work, and I can recommend it wholeheartedly to you. It's one of these best-kept secrets in the Lutheran Church, Lutheran World Relief. 50 years of experience. Money Magazine has a list every year of the best overseas aid agencies in the country, and LWR is usually in the top 10. But you know what happened last year? It's not in the top 10. Not because it was actually the most efficient of those listed. Something like 93%, 93 cents on the dollar of money you give to LWR goes overseas, because of the way we work with foreign partnerships. We don't have massive American establishments around the world to maintain. It's a very lean and efficient organization, I think. But we weren't on the list. Why? They decided there were too many to catalog, so they do a cutoff at $30 million. And without some U.S. government contracts, which we sometimes manage for a road in Sudan or a special program in Somalia or something, we didn't have $30 million to talk about. Well, how many Lutherans are there? You know, this figure we have is 7.5 million. Doesn't take a great deal of math to divide 7.5 million into the figure we had last year, which is 20 million. And that's putting a dollar value on the quilts and the clothing, which is collected so generously in so many parishes. It comes down, when you add up what is given for world hunger in the ELC and the LCMS, to something like a cheeseburger per Lutheran per year.
John, you're saying it's 20 million is your annual outlay?
20 million was our outlay last year
for
Lutheran World Relief.
I'm just thinking my Lutheran Social Service Agency, our budget is 32 million.
Yeah, your agency.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tell you, the scale between our international involvement as Christians, where the needs are, you could say, and our budgets at home, even in worthy causes, is sort of staggering. It's the same in the public sphere. The foreign aid as a component of our budget is a pathetic, tiny, we've been over this a couple times in the past weeks, but it's less than 0.5% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid. Something is badly, I think, in need of at least scrutiny here. When, as one of the hunger appeal folks in the ELCA says, you tip more at a good meal out with 4 or 5 or 6 people than we as a body give to world hunger in a year. And I think it's in this money age where money talks, and we heard this morning about money in the Bible study, and last night the pianist corrected her spokesperson, you know, and said, we want your money. I think we have to be pretty upfront to say that it is pretty darn possible to act on your faith by sharing of your money in these very active ways. That airplane that flies to Goma, it doesn't fly on goodwill or, you know, health kits. It carries them, but it needs money to get there. And that's a fact I don't think we can escape. The video section I want to show you is, as I said, approaching this topic from a little different angle, taking that cue from giving without pay, we receive without pay, taking the sense that the banquet is something which God has set for us. And in a way, all we are doing is rearranging a little tiny part of His bounty, the bounty He's entrusted to us, which is adequate, really, to meet the needs of so many around the world, if it were only shared more fully. And if someone would push the button on the back of the machine at the back, it will warm up. Can you see the dot on the top? On the top, at the rear. There's a big, yeah. And sir, I think your head is going to be... Any comments or questions while we're just waiting for this thing to come on?
Now, the average congregation in their money received, does each congregation decide? Does some of it automatically go to Lutheran World Relief, or how is that? Do people give directly?
If you give to the hunger appeal, we get a third of that, and the other stuff goes. The rest of it goes to similar causes through other channels. So that's where it comes in at the congregational level. You can designate it for LWR, but the general way is to give it to each church's hunger appeal, because LWR is representing both churches. You know, other people give directly as individuals. A few parishes give directly, but it's great to lift up the body, the activity of the church in this area, which is the hunger appeal. And Bob Marshall, who was the LWR chairman for a long time and former LCA presidents, reminded us at our anniversary that the hunger appeal was one thing the people demanded of the church. It was something the churches didn't have. The leadership didn't institute it. The people said, we have to have a hunger appeal. And it's been there ever since. I think it started in the early 70s.
Is it the United Way agency?
No. The United Way is totally secular. This is a particular ministry in the sense of Acts and of Matthew for the needy of the world by Lutherans. And as I say, it's supported faithfully by a few people, but I think not maybe known as an option by quite a few. Before you hit it, let me introduce those of you who weren't here yesterday. This is part of an hour-long show called Storybarn World Friends. Storybarn has puppets for hosts, and there's Gertie the chicken, and in this case, World Turtle, who belongs to Lutheran World Relief, and they found a mysterious gift in their barn, and this gift makes them think what they're going to need to provide for this, whatever it is, as it's going to live. And that is the device through which we go around the world. The egg itself, the mysterious gift, answers by making some sounds which take us to places around the world. Yesterday we went to Kenya, and the topic was food that people
with a little help from outside, can do the right thing by their community and have a bounty of the right kind of food and nutrition for the community.